He's a middle-aged civil servant. He might get hurt. They crossed the road and quietly entered the front patch. A dim light was burning behind the curtains of the basement flat. They descended the steps in silence, and Preston rang the bell. There was a clack of heels inside, and the door opened. Framed in the light was a woman. When she saw the two men, the smile of welcome dropped from her heavily calmed lips. She tried to shut the door, but Lander pushed it open, elbowed her aside, and ran past her. She was no spring chicken, but she had done her best. Wavy black hair fell to shoulder length to frame the heavily made-up face. There had been extravagant use of mascara and shadow around the eyes, rouge on the cheeks, and a smear of bright lipstick across the mouth. Before she had time to close the front of the housecoat, Preston caught a glimpse of black stockings and suspenders, and a tight-waisted busk picked out in red ribbon. He guided her by the elbow down the hall to the sitting-room and sat her down. She stared at the carpet. They sat in silence while Lander searched the flat. Lander knew fugitives sometimes hid under beds and in cupboards. He did a good job. After 10 minutes, he emerged from the rear area, slightly flushed. "Not a sign of him, sir. He must have done a bunk through the back and over the garden fences to the next street." Just then there was a ring at the front door. "Your people, sir?" asked Lander to Preston. Preston shook his head. "Not with a single ring," he replied. Lander went to open the front door. Preston heard an oath and the sound of running footsteps. Later it transpired a man had come to the door, and on seeing the detective opening it, had tried to flee. Birkinshaw's people had closed in at the top of the steps and held the man until the pursuing Lander had got the cuffs on him. After that, the man went quiet and was led away to the police car. Preston sat with the woman and listened to the tumult die away. "It's not an arrest," he said quietly. "But I think we should go to head office, don't you?" The woman nodded miserably. "Do you mind if I get changed first?" "I think that would be a good idea, Sir Richard," said Preston. An hour later, a burly but very gay truck driver was released from Paddington Green Police Station, having been seriously advised on the unwisdom of answering blind-date advertisements in adult contact magazines. John Preston escorted Sir Richard Peters to the country, stayed with him, listening to what he had to say until midnight, drove back to London, and spent the rest of the night writing his report. This report was in front of each member of the Paragon Committee when they met at 11 on Friday morning. The expressions of bewilderment and distaste were general. "Good grief," thought Sir Martin Flannery, the Cabinet Secretary, to himself. "First Hayman, then Trestrel, then done it, and now this. Can't these wretches ever keep their flies buttoned up?" The last man to finish the report looked up. "Quite appalling," said Sir Hubert Villiers of the Home Office. "Don't think we'll be wanting the chap back at the Ministry," said Sir Perry Jones of Defence. "Where is he now?" asked Sir Anthony Plum of MI5's Director General, who sat next to Brian Harcourt Smith. "In one of our houses in the country," said Sir Bernard Hemmings. "He has already telephoned the Ministry, purporting to phone from his cottage at Edenbridge to say he slipped on a patch of ice yesterday evening and cracked a bone in his ankle. He said he's in plaster and will be off for a fortnight, doctor's orders. That should hold things for a while."
"Aren't we overlooking one question?" murmured Sir Nigel Irvine of MI6. "Regardless of his unusual tastes, is he our man? Is he the leak?"
Brian Harcourt Smith cleared his throat.
"Interrogation, gentlemen, is in its early stages," he said, "but it does seem likely that he is, as certainly he would be a prime likelihood for recruitment by blackmail."
"Time is becoming of the very essence," interposed Sir Patrick Strickland of the Foreign Office. "We still have the matter of damage assessment hanging over us, and at my end the question of what and when do we tell our allies."
"We could intensify the interrogation," suggested Harcourt Smith. "I believe that way we would have our answer within 24 hours.
There was an uncomfortable silence. The thought of one of their colleagues, whatever he had done, being worked over by the hard team was not a comfortable one. Sir Martin Flannery felt his stomach turn. He had a deep personal aversion to violence.
"Surely that is not necessary at this stage," he asked.
Sir Nigel Irvine raised his head from the report. "Bernard, this man Preston, the investigating officer,
He seems a pretty good man.
He is, affirmed Sir Bernard Hemmings.
I was wondering, continued Irvine with deceptive diffidence, he seems to have spent some hours with Peters in the immediate aftermath of the events in Bayswater. I wonder if it might be helpful for this committee to have the opportunity of listening to him.
I debriefed him myself, personally, this morning, interjected Harcourt Smith rapidly. I'm sure I can answer any questions as to what happened.
The chief of six was consumed with apology. My dear Brian, there is no doubt in my mind about that, he said.
It is just that, well, sometimes one can get an impression from interrogating a subject that ill conveys itself on paper. I don't know what the committee thinks, but we're going to have to make a decision as to what happens next. I just thought it might be helpful to listen to the one man who has talked to Peters.
There was a succession of nods around the table. Hemmings dispatched an evidently irritated Harcourt Smith to the telephone to summon Preston. While the mandarins waited, coffee was served. Preston was shown in 30 minutes later. The senior men examined him with some curiosity. He was given a chair at the centre of the table, opposite his own Director-General and DDG. Sir Anthony Plum explained the committee's dilemma.
"Just what happened between you?"
asked Sir Anthony. Preston thought for a moment. "In the car, on the way down to the country, he broke down," said Preston. "Up till then he had maintained a form of composure, although under great strain. I took him down alone, driving myself. He started to cry and talk."
"Yes?" prompted Sir Anthony. "What did he say?"
"He admitted his taste for transvestite fetishism, but seemed stunned by the accusation of treason. He denied it hotly and continued to do so until I left him with the minders."
"Well, he would," said Brian Harcourt Smith. "He could still be our man."
"Yes, indeed he could," agreed Preston.
"But your impression, your gut feeling," murmured Sir Nigel Irvine.
Preston took a deep breath.
"Gentlemen, I don't think he is."
"May we ask why?" said Sir Anthony.
"As Sir Nigel implies, it's just a gut feeling," said Preston. "I've seen two men whose world had shattered about them and who believed they had not much left to live for. When men in that mood spill, they tend to spill the lot.
A rare man of great composure, like Philby or Blunt, can hold out. But those were ideological traitors, convinced Marxists. If Sir Richard Peters was blackmailed into treachery, I think he would either have admitted it when the House of Cards came tumbling down, or at least shown no surprise at the accusation of treason. He did show complete surprise. He could have been acting, but I think he was beyond acting by then. Either that, or he ought to have an Oscar." It was a long speech from such a junior man in the presence of the Paragon Committee, and there was silence for a while. Harcourt Smith was looking daggers at Preston. Sir Nigel studied Preston with interest. In view of his office, he knew about the Londonderry incident that had blown Preston's cover as an army undercover man. He also noted Harcourt Smith's gaze and wondered why the DDG at five seemed to dislike Preston. His own opinion was favourable.
"What do you think, Nigel?" asked Sir Anthony Plum.
Irvine nodded. "I too have seen the mood of utter collapse that overtakes a traitor when he is exposed. Basil, Prime, both weak and inadequate men, and they both spilled the lot when the house came tumbling down. So, if not Peters, that seems to leave George Berenson."
"It's been a month," complained Sir Patrick Strickland. "We really have got to nail the culprit one way or the other."
"The culprit could still be a personal assistant or secretary on the staff of either of these two men," pointed out Sir Perry Jones. "Isn't that so, Mr. Preston?"
"Quite true, sir," said Preston.
"Then we are going to have to clear George Berenson, or prove he's our man," said Sir Patrick Strickland in some exasperation. "Even if he's cleared, that leaves us Peters. And if he won't cough, we're back to square one."
"May I make a suggestion?" asked Preston quietly. There was some surprise. He had not been asked here to make suggestions. But Sir Anthony Plum's a courteous man.
"Please do," he said.
The 10 documents returned by the anonymous sender all fell within a pattern, said Preston. The men round the table nodded. 7 of them, Preston continued, contained material affecting Britain's and NATO's naval dispositions in the Atlantic, north and south. That seems to be an area of NATO planning of particular interest to our leak or his controllers.
Would it be possible to cause to pass across Mr. Berenson's desk a document of such irresistible tastiness that, if he is the guilty party, he would be sorely tempted to abstract a copy and make a move to pass it on? A number of heads around the table nodded thoughtfully.
Smoke 'em out, you mean, mused Sir Bernard Hemmings. And what do you think, Nigel?
You know, I think I like it. It might just work. Could it be done, Perry?
Sir Perry Jones pursed his lips.
Actually, more realistically than you think, he said. When I was in America, the idea was mooted, and I haven't passed it further yet, that we might one day need to increase to refueling and revictualling level our facilities on Ascension Island to include facilities for our nuclear submarines. The Americans were very interested and suggested they might help with the costs if they too could have facilities. It would save our subs going back to Faslane and those endless demonstrations up there, and save the Yankees having to go back to Norfolk, Virginia. I suppose I could prepare a very confidential personal paper beefing that idea up to agreed policy level and slip it across four or five desks, including Berenson's.
Would Berenson normally see that kind of paper? Asked Sir Paddy Strickland.
Certainly, said Jones. As Deputy Chief of Defence Procurement, his section is responsible for the nuclear side of things. He would have to get it, along with three or four others. Some copies would be run off close colleagues' eyes only, then returned and shredded. Original back to me by hand.
It was agreed. The Ascension Island paper would land on George Berenson's desk on Tuesday. As they left the Cabinet Office, Sir Nigel Irvine invited Sir Bernard Hemmings to join him for lunch.
Good man, that Preston, suggested Irvine. Like the cut of his jib. Is he loyal to you?
I've every reason to think so, said Sir Bernard, puzzled.
Ah, that might explain things, thought C enigmatically.
That Sunday, the 22nd, the British Prime Minister spent at her official country residence, Chequers, in the county of Buckinghamshire. In conditions of complete secrecy, she asked three of her closest advisers in the cabinet and the chairman of the party to drive out privately to see her. What she had to say caused them all deep thought. That coming June, she would have been in power for 4 years of her second term. She was determined to go for a third successive election victory. The economic indicators suggested a downturn in the autumn, accompanied by a wave of wage demands. There could be strikes. She wished to have no repeat of the winter of discontent of 1978, when a wave of labour stoppages crippled the credibility of the Labour government and led to its fall in May 1979. Furthermore, with the Social Democrat Liberal Alliance stuck in the public opinion polls at 20%, Labour, with its newfound veneer of unity and moderation, had increased its popular rating to 37% of the electorate, just 6 points behind the Conservatives, and the gap was closing. In short, she wanted to go for a snap June election, but without the damaging speculation that preceded and hastened her decision in 1983. A sudden, out-of-the-blue declaration and a 3-week election campaign was what she wanted, not in 1988 or even the autumn of 1987, but that summer. She bound her colleagues to silence, but the date she favoured was the penultimate Thursday in June, the 18th. On Monday, Sir Nigel Irvine had his meet with Andreev. It was very covert, on Hampstead Heath. A screen of Irvine's own people was scattered over the heath to ensure Andreev was himself not under surveillance by the Soviet embassy's own KR, counterintelligence goons. But he was clean. Britain's own cover of the Soviet diplomats' movements had been called off. Sir Nigel Irvine handled Andreev as a director's case. These are unusual, because men as high in the service, any service, as the chief himself, do not usually run an agent. It may happen because of the exceptional importance of the agent, or because original recruiting was done before the controller became his services director, and the agent refuses to be handled by anyone else. This was the problem with Andreev. Back in February 1972, Nigel Irvine, then plain Mr. Irvine, had been head of station in Tokyo. In that month, the Japanese counter-terrorist people had decided to take out the headquarters of the fanatical ultra-left Red Army faction, which was located in a villa in the snow on the slopes of Mount Otakine, at a place called Asama-so.
The National Police Agency actually did the job, but under the command of the redoubtable counter-terrorist chief, Mr. Sussa, who was a friend of Irvin. Providing some of the experience gleaned by Britain's crack SAS units, Irvin was able to be of some advisory help to Mr. Sussa, and some of his suggestions saved a number of Japanese lives. Aware of his country's strict neutrality, Mr. Sussa did not thank Irvin in any particular way, but at a diplomatic cocktail party a month later, the brilliant and subtle Japanese had caught Irvin's eye and nodded in the direction of a Russian diplomat across the room. Then he had smiled and moved away. Irvin closed on the Russian and discovered he was newly arrived in Tokyo and his name was Andreev. Irvin had the man tailed and discovered he was foolishly having a clandestine affair with a Japanese girl, an offence that would immediately break him with his own people. Of course, the Japanese already knew this because every Soviet diplomat in Tokyo is quietly followed whenever they leave the embassy. Irvin had set up a honey trap, acquired the appropriate photographs and tape recordings, and finally burst in on Andreev using the crash-bang-gotcha technique. The Russian had nearly collapsed, thinking he was being raided by his own people. As he pulled his trousers on, he agreed to talk to Irvin. He was something of a catch. For one thing, he was from the KGB's Illegals Directorate, a Line N man. The first chief directorate of the KGB, responsible for all overseas activities, is divided into directorates, special departments, and ordinary departments. Ordinary Soviet KGB agents under diplomatic cover come from one of the territorial departments. The seventh department happens to cover Japan. These staffers are called PR line when on posting abroad, and they do the run-of-the-mill trawling for information, making of useful contacts, reading of technical publications, etc. But at the most secret heart of the first chief directorate lies the Illegals, or S directorate, which knows no territorial boundaries. The Illegals people train and run the illegal agents, those not under diplomatic immunity, those who go in on the ground, under deep cover with false papers and on secret missions. The Illegals operate outside the embassy. Nevertheless, inside every KGB residentura, in every Soviet embassy, there is usually one S directorate man, known on overseas posting as Line N people. These handle special assignments only, often running spies indigenous to the country against which they are spying, or just assisting with backup and technical support to deep cover illegal coming in from the Soviet bloc. Andreev was from the S Directorate. Even more oddly, he was not a Japan expert, as all the Seventh Department colleagues in the embassy would have to be. He was an English language expert, and the reason he was there at all was to pursue a contact with a United States Air Force Master Sergeant who had been talent-spotted in San Diego and transferred to the joint USAF-Japanese base at Tashikawa. With no hope of explaining himself to his own superiors back in Moscow, Andreev had agreed to work for Irvin. The cozy arrangement came to an end when the American sergeant, pushed beyond endurance, dispatched himself rather untidily with his service revolver in the commissary latrine, and Andreev was sent back to Moscow in a hurry. Irvin thought of burning the man there and then, but he desisted. And then he had showed up in London. A batch of new photographs had drifted across Sir Nigel Irvin's desk 6 months earlier, and there he was. Transferred out of the S Directorate and back onto PR line work, Andreev was accredited as a second secretary in the Soviet embassy. Sir Nigel had put the hooks in again. Andreev had little choice but to cooperate, but he refused to be handled by anyone else, so Sir Nigel took him on as a director's case. On the matter of the leak in the British Defence Ministry, he had little to offer. He knew of no such thing. If there was such a leak, then the man in the ministry could be controlled directly from some illegal Soviet agent resident in Britain who would contact Moscow direct, or he could be being run by one of the three Line N people inside the embassy. But such people would not discuss a case of that importance over coffee in the canteen. He personally had heard nothing, but he would keep his eyes and ears open. On that note, the two men on Hampstead Heath parted. The Ascension Island paper was distributed on Tuesday by Sir Peregrine Jones, who had spent Monday preparing it. It went to four men. Bertie Capstick had agreed to enter the ministry each night
and check on legitimate photocopies made. Preston had told his watchers he wanted to know if George Berenson scratched his neck immediately. He told his mail intercept people the same, and put his phone tap team on full alert. Then they settled down to wait.
Chapter 8. On the first day, nothing happened. That night, Brigadier Capstick, with John Preston, went into the Ministry of Defence while the staff were sleeping and checked the number of photocopies run off. There were 7. 3 by George Berenson, 2 each by 2 of the other mandarins who had had the Ascension Island paper circulated to them, and none by the 4th man. On the evening of the second day, Mr. Berenson did something strange. The watchers reported that in the middle of the evening he left his Belgravia apartment and walked to a nearby call box. They could not tell the number he dialed, but he spoke only a few words, replaced the receiver, and walked home. Why, Preston wondered, should a man do that who had a perfectly serviceable telephone in his flat, something Preston could vouch for since he was tapping it? On Thursday, the third day, George Berenson left the ministry at the usual time, hailed a cab, and went to St. John's Wood. In the high street of this parish, with its village-like atmosphere, was an ice cream parlour and coffee shop. The defence official went in, sat down, and ordered a sundae, one of the specialities of the house. John Preston sat in the basement radio room in Cork Street and listened to the watcher team leader reporting in. It was Len Stewart, leading the A-team. "I've got 2 people in there," he said, "and 2 more out here on the street, plus my cars." "What's he doing in there?" asked Preston. "Can't see," said Stewart over his personal radio. "Have to wait until the people in there with him get a chance to tell me." In fact, Mr. Berenson, ensconced in an alcove, was eating his ice cream sundae and filling in the last squares of the crossword in the Daily Telegraph, which he had produced from his briefcase. He took no notice of the 2 jeans-clad students canoodling in the corner. After 30 minutes, the official called for his bill, took it to the cash desk, paid, and left. "He's back on the street," called Len Stewart. "My 2 have stayed inside. He's walking up the high street, looking for a taxi, I think. I can see my people inside now. They're paying at the desk." "Can you ask them what he did in there?" asked Preston. There was something odd, he thought, about the whole episode. It might be a specialist ice cream parlour, but there were others in Mayfair and the West End, and a straight line from the Ministry to Belgravia. Why go north of Regent's Park to St. John's Wood for an ice cream? Stewart's voice came over the air again. "There's a taxi coming. He's hailing it. Hold on, here are my people from the inside." There was a pause in transmission. Then, "It seems he ate his ice cream and completed the Daily Telegraph crossword, then he paid up and left." "Where's the paper?" asked Preston. "He left it when he finished." "Hold on." Then the proprietor came over and cleared the table, taking the dirty bowl and paper back into the kitchen area. "He's inside the taxi and cruising. What do we do, stay with him?" Preston thought furiously. Harry Birkinshaw and the B-team had been taken off Sir Richard Peters and allowed a few days' rest. They had been out in rain, cold and fog for weeks. There was only one team on the job now. If he split that team and lost Berenson, who then went on to make his contact somewhere else, Harcourt Smith would have his hide nailed to a barn door. He made his decision. "Len, leave 1 car and driver to tail the taxi. I know it's not enough if he slips away on foot, but switch the rest of your people to the ice cream parlour." "Will do," said Len Stewart, and went off the air. Preston was in luck. The taxi went straight to Mr. Berenson's West End club and dropped him off. He went inside. But then, thought Preston, the contact could be in there. Len Stewart entered the ice cream shop and sat until closing time with a coffee and the Standard. Nothing happened. He was asked to leave at closing time and did so. From up and down the street, the 4-man team saw the staff of the shop leave, the proprietor close up, the lights go out. From Cork Street, Preston was trying to get a phone tap on the ice cream shop and a make on the proprietor. It turned out to be a Signor Benotti, a legal immigrant originally from Naples who had led a blameless life for 20 years. By midnight, Preston had a tap on the ice cream parlour and Signor Benotti's home in Swiss Cottage. It produced nothing. Preston spent a sleepless night in Cork Street. Stewart's relief shift had moved in at 8 p.m. and watched the ice cream shop and Minotti's house through the night.
At 9 on the Friday morning, Bonatti walked back to his shop, and at 10 it opened for business. Len Stewart and the day shift took over at the same hour. At 11, Stewart called in. "There's a small delivery van at the front door," he told Preston. "The van man seems to be loading gallon tubs of ice cream. It seems they do a customer delivery service." Preston stirred his 20th cup of awful coffee. His mind was fogging with lack of sleep. "I know," he said. "There's been reference to it on the telephone already. Detach a car and 2 people to stay with the van. Note every recipient of ice cream deliveries." "It only leaves me and a car and 2 people here, including myself," said Stewart. "It's damn thin on the ground." "There's a bidding conference going on up at Charles. I'll try and get an extra team," said Preston. The ice cream delivery van made 12 calls that morning, all in the St. John's Wood Swiss Cottage area, with 2 as far south as Marylebone. Some of the calls were in apartment blocks, where it was hard for the watchers to appear inconspicuous, but they noted every address. Then the van drove back to the shop. It made no afternoon deliveries. "Will you drop that list at Cork on your way home?" Preston asked Stewart. That evening, the phone tap people reported Berenson had had 4 telephone calls while he was at home, including one in which the caller turned out to have a wrong number. He had made no outgoing calls. Everything was on tape. Did Preston want the tape to play over? There was nothing remotely suspicious on it. He thought he might as well. On Saturday morning, Preston played the longest shot of his life. Using a tape recorder set up by the technical support people and a variety of excuses to the householders, he called up each one of the recipients of the ice cream, asking whenever a woman answered if he might speak to her husband. Being Saturday, he got them all but one. One voice seemed slightly familiar. What was it? A hint of accent. And where could he have heard it before? He checked the name of the householder. It meant nothing. He ate a moody lunch in a cafe near Cork Street. The connection came to him over the coffee. He hurried back to Cork Street and played the tapes again. Possible, not conclusive, but possible. Scotland Yard, among the copious facilities of its forensic science department, has a section devoted to voice analysis, useful whenever a target criminal, having had his phone tapped, denies it was his voice in the tape. MI5, having no forensic facilities, has to rely on Scotland Yard for this sort of thing, an arrangement usually secured via the special branch. Preston called Detective Sergeant Lander, got him at home, and it was Lander who fixed a priority meeting at Scotland Yard's voice analysis section that same Saturday afternoon. There was only one technician available. He was loath to leave his televised football game to come to work, but he did. A thin young man with pebble glasses, he played Preston's tapes 6 times, watching the illuminated line on the oscilloscope screen rise and fall to record the tiniest shades of tone and timbre in the voices. "Same voice," he said at last. "No question about it." On Sunday, Preston identified the owner of the accented voice by using the diplomatic list. He also called a friend in the science department of London University, spoiling his day off by asking for a considerable favour, and finally telephoned Sir Bernard Hemmings at his Surrey home. "I think there is something that we should report to the Paragon Committee, sir," he said, "like tomorrow morning." The Paragon Committee met at 11, and Sir Anthony Plum asked Preston to make his report. There was an air of expectancy, although Sir Bernard Hemmings looked grave. Preston detailed the events of the first 2 days since the distribution of the Ascension Island paper as briefly as he could. There was a stir of interest at the news of Berenson's odd and very brief call from a public phone box on the Wednesday evening. "Did you tape record that call?" asked Sir Peregrine Jones. "No, sir, we couldn't get near enough," replied Preston. "Then what do you think it was for?" "I believe Mr. Berenson was alerting his controller to a pending drop, probably using a code to indicate the time and place." "Have you any proof of that?" asked Sir Hubert Villiers of the Home Office. "No, sir." Preston went on to describe the visit to the ice cream parlour, the abandonment of the Daily Telegraph, and the fact it was cleared away by the proprietor personally. "Did you manage to recover the paper?" asked Sir Paddy Strickland. "No, sir. To have raided the ice cream shop then might have caused the arrest of Mr. Bonatti and perhaps Mr. Berenson, but Bonatti could have pleaded complete innocence that there was anything inside the newspaper, and Mr. Berenson could have pleaded that he had made a terribly careless mistake." "But you believe the visit to the ice cream shop was the drop?" asked Sir Anthony Plum. "I'm sure of it," said Preston. He went on to describe the delivery of 1 gallon tubs of ice cream to 12 customers the next morning, how he had obtained voice samples of 11 of them, and of Berenson's receipt of a wrong number call that same evening. The voice that dialed him that evening and established that the caller had obtained a wrong number, apologized and rang off, was the voice of one of the recipients of the ice cream. There was silence round the table.
"Could it have been a coincidence?" asked Sir Hubert Villiers doubtfully. "There are an awful lot of perfectly innocent wrong numbers dialed in this city. Get them myself all the time."
"I checked with a friend yesterday who has access to a computer," said Preston levelly. "The chances of a man in a city of 12 million going into an ice cream parlour for a Sunday, of that ice cream parlour delivering to 12 customers the next morning, and of one of those customers speaking through a wrong number to the ice cream eater by midnight, are over 1,000,000 to 1. The telephone call on Friday evening was an acknowledgement of safe receipt."
"Let me see if I understand," said Sir Perry Jones. "Berenson recovered from his 3 colleagues their photocopies of my fictitious paper and pretended to shred them all. In fact, he retained 1. He folded it inside his newspaper and left it in the ice cream shop. The proprietor collected the paper, plastic-wrapped the classified document, and delivered it next morning to the controller in a tub of ice cream. The controller then alerted Berenson that he had got it."
"That is what I believe happened," said Preston.
"Chances of 1,000,000 to 1, mused Sir Anthony Plum. "Nigel, what do you think?"
The chief of SIS shook his head. "I don't believe in chances of 1,000,000 to 1, he said. "Not in our work, eh, Bernard?" "No, it was a drop, all right. From the source to the controller, via a cutout, Signor Benotti. Mr. Preston has got it right. My congratulations. Berenson's our man."
"So, what have you done since you made this connection, Mr. Preston?" asked Sir Anthony.
"I have switched the surveillance from Mr. Berenson to the controller," said Preston. "I've identified him. In fact, this morning I joined the watchers and followed him from his Malibu flat, where he lives alone as a bachelor, to his office. He is a foreign diplomat. His name is Mr. Jan Marais."
"Jan? That sounds Czech," said Sir Perry Jones.
"Not quite," said Preston somberly. "Jan Marais is an accredited diplomat of the staff of the Embassy of the Republic of South Africa." There was a stunned, disbelieving silence. Sir Paddy Strickland, in language not habitually favoured by diplomats, muttered, "Bloody hell." All eyes turned to Sir Nigel Irvine. He sat at the end of the table, badly shaken. "If it's true," he thought privately, "I'll have his balls for cocktail olives." He was thinking of General Henri Pienaar, head of South Africa's National Intelligence Service, successor to the late, unlamented Boss. For the South Africans to hire a few London crooks to burgle the archives of the African National Congress was one thing. To run a spy right inside the British Defence Ministry was, between services, a declaration of war.
"I think, gentlemen, with your indulgence, I'm going to have to ask for a few days to investigate this matter a little further," said Sir Nigel.
2 days later, on the 4th of March, one of the senior cabinet ministers, in whom Mrs. Thatcher had confided her desire to go for an early general election, was having breakfast with his wife in their handsome townhouse in Holland Park, London. The wife was browsing through a sheaf of holiday brochures.
"Corfu is nice," she said. "Or Crete?"
There was no response, so she pressed her point.
"Darling, we should try and get away for a fortnight of complete rest this summer. It's been nearly 2 years, after all. What about June? Before the crush, but when the weather is at its best."
"Not June," said the minister, without looking up.
"But June's beautiful," she protested.
"Not June," he repeated. "Anything but June."
Her eyes widened.
"What's so important about June?"
"Never mind."
"You cunning old fox," she said breathlessly. "It's Margaret, isn't it? That cosy little chat at Checkers last Sunday week. She's going to the country. Well, I'll be damned."
"Shh,"
said her husband. But after 25 years she knew when she had got it right. She looked up to see Emma, their daughter, standing in the doorway.
"Are you off, darling?"
"Yeah," said the girl. "See you." Emma Lockwood was 19, a student at Art College, and subscribed, with all her youthful enthusiasm, to radical politics. She abominated her father's political views and sought to protest against them by her own lifestyle. To her parents' tolerant exasperation, she was never missing from anti-nuclear protest. One of her areas of personal protest was to sleep with Simon Devine, a lecturer at a polytechnic college, whom she had met on a demo. He was no great lover, but impressed her by his firebrand Trotskyism and pathological hatred of the bourgeoisie, which appeared to include anyone who did not agree with him. Those able to disagree more effectively than the bourgeoisie were termed fascists. To him, that evening, in his bedsitter, she vouchsafed the tip she had overheard while standing in the doorway of her parents' breakfast room. Devine was a member of a number of revolutionary study groups and contributed articles to hard-left publications of great passion and small circulation. 2 days later, he mentioned the nugget he had obtained from Emma Lockwood while he was in conference with one of the editors of a small broadsheet for whom he had prepared an article calling on all freedom-loving car workers at Cowley to destroy the production line over the issue of one of their number who had been fired for theft. The editor advised Devine there was not enough in the rumour to make an article for the publication, but that he would discuss the information with his colleagues and advised Devine to keep it to himself. When Devine had gone, the editor did indeed discuss it with one of his colleagues, his conduit, and the conduit passed it on to the controller in the Residentura inside the Soviet embassy. On the 10th of March, the news reached Moscow. Devine would have been appalled. As an ardent follower of Trotsky's call for instant global revolution, he hated Moscow and all it stood for. Sir Nigel Irvine had been shaken by the revelation that the controller of a major spy within the British establishment was a South African diplomat, and took up the only option left to him, a direct approach to the South African NIS to ask for an explanation. The relationship between the British SIS and the South African NIS and its predecessor, the BOS, would be described by a politician of either country as non-existent. Arm's length would be more realistic. It exists, but for political reasons it is a difficult one. Under successive British governments, because of the widespread distaste for the apartheid doctrine, the relationship has always been frowned on, more under Labour governments than Conservative. During the Labour years between 1964 and 1979, it was allowed to continue, oddly, because of the Rhodesian imbroglio. Labour Prime Minister Harold Wilson accepted that he needed all the information he could get on Ian Smith's Rhodesia to implement his sanctions, and the South Africans had most of it. By the time that affair was over, the Conservatives were back in power in May 1979, and the relationship continued, this time due to concern over Namibia and Angola, where it had to be admitted that South Africans had good networks. Nor was the relationship one-sided. It was the British who received a tip from the West Germans about the East German links to the wife of South African Navy Commodore Dieter Gerhardt. He was later arrested as a Sovblock spy. The British also tipped off the South Africans about a couple of Soviet illegals entering South Africa, using the SIS encyclopedic files on such gentlemen. There was one unpleasant hiccup in 1967 when an agent of the BOS, one Norman Blackburn, working as a barman at the Zambezi Club, bestowed his charms upon one of the garden girls. These are secretaries at 10 Downing Street, so called because they work in a room facing the garden. The infatuated Helen, the name will suffice because she's long settled down with her family, passed several classified documents to Blackburn before the affair was discovered. It caused a stink, and led to Harold Wilson's conviction ever afterwards that whatever went wrong, from corked wine to crop failure, was due to the BOS. After that, the relationship steadied onto a more civilized course. The British maintain, therefore, a head of station of whom the NIS is informed, and who is normally resident in Johannesburg. No active measures are conducted by the British on South African territory. The South Africans maintain several staffers at their embassy in London, of whom SIS is aware, and a few outside the embassy, on whom MI5 keeps a watchful eye. The task of the latter is to monitor the London-end activities of various South African revolutionary organisations like ANC, SWAPO, and so forth. As long as the South Africans confine themselves to this, they are left alone. It was the British head of station in Johannesburg who sought and got a personal interview with General Henri Pienaar and reported back to his chief in London what the head of the NIS had to say. Sir Nigel convened a meeting of the Paragon Committee on the 10th of March.
The great and good General Pinar swears by all that he holds to be holy that he has no knowledge of Jan Marais. He claims Marais does not work for him and never has.
Is he telling the truth? Asked Sir Paddy Strickland.
In this game one should never count on it, said Sir Nigel.
But it could be he is. For one thing, he would have known for 3 days now that we have uncovered Marais. If Marais is his, he would know we would take terrible revenge. He has not moved out any of his people here, which I think he would if he knew he were guilty.
Then what the hell is Marais? Asked Sir Perry Jones.
Pinar claims he would like to know as much as we would, answered C. In fact, he has agreed to my request to receive our investigator to carry out a joint hunt with his own people. I want to send a man down there.
And what is the position on Berenson and Marais now?
Asked Sir Anthony Plum of Harcourt Smith, who was representing Five.
Both men are under discreet surveillance, but no moves have been made to close in. No break into either man's apartment, just mail intercept, phone tap, and the watchers round the clock, replied Harcourt Smith.
How long do you want, Nigel? Asked Plum.
10 days.
All right, and that's the limit. In 10 days we have to move against Berenson with whatever we've got and start into damage assessment with his willing or unwilling cooperation.
The next day, Sir Nigel Irvine called Sir Bernard Hemmings at his home outside Farnham, where the ailing man was confined.
Bernard, that man of yours, Preston, I know it's unusual. I could send one of my own people and all that, but I like his style. Could I borrow him for the South African trip?
Sir Bernard agreed. Preston flew to Johannesburg on the overnight flight of the 12th to 13th March. It was not until he was airborne that the information reached the desk of Brian Harcourt Smith. He was icily angry, but knew he had been outranked. The Albion Committee reported to the General Secretary on the evening of the 12th and was received in his apartment on Kutuzovsky Prospekt. And what, pray, have you got for me? The Soviet leader asked quietly. Professor Krylov, as chairman of the committee, gestured towards Grand Master Rogov, who opened the file in front of him and began to read. As always in the presence of the General Secretary, Philby was impressed, even awed, by the sheer, untrammelled power of the man. During the committee's researches, the mere mention of his name as the overriding authority could have secured them anything they wanted in the USSR and no questions asked. As a student of power and its application, Philby had admired the ruthless and cunning way in which the General Secretary had secured absolute power over every tendril of life in the Soviet Union. Years earlier, when he had been given the powerful chairmanship of the KGB, it had not been as an appointee of Brezhnev, but of the unpublicized kingmaker of the Politburo, the party ideologue Mikhail Suslov. With this residual independence from Brezhnev and his personal mafia, he had ensured the KGB never became Brezhnev's unquestioning poodle. When, in May 1982, with Suslov dead and Brezhnev dying, he had quit the KGB to return to the Central Committee, he had not made the same mistake. Behind him, as chairman of the KGB, he had left General Fedorchuk, his personal placeman. From inside the party, the General Secretary had consolidated his position with the Central Committee and then bided his time through the brief Andropov and Chernenko eras until his eventual accession. Within months of that accession, he had sewn up the power sources, party, armed forces, KGB and Interior Ministry, the MVD. With all the aces in his hands, no one dared oppose or conspire.
"We have devised a plan, Comrade General Secretary," said Dr. Rogov, using, as they were among others, the formal term of address. "It is a concrete plan, an active measure, a proposal to cause a destabilization among the British people that would make the Sarajevo affair and the Berlin Reichstag fire pale into insignificance. We have called it Plan Aurora."
It took him an hour to read the full details. He glanced up occasionally to see if there was any reaction, but the General Secretary was a grand master in a much bigger game of chess, and his face remained blank. At last, Rogov had finished. There was silence while they waited.
"It has risks," said the General Secretary quietly.
What guarantees are there that it would not backfire, like certain other operations?
He had not mentioned the word, but they all knew what he meant. In his last year at the KGB, he had been badly shaken by the dismal failure of the Wojtyła affair. It had taken 3 years for the rumbles and accusations to die away, and it had caused the sort of global publicity the USSR definitely did not need. In the early spring of 1981, the Bulgarian Secret Service had reported that their people among the Turkish community in West Germany had trawled a strange fish. For ethnic, cultural, and historical reasons, the Bulgars, most loyal and subservient of Russia's satellites, were deeply involved in Turkey and the Turks. The man they had picked up was a dedicated terrorist killer who had been trained by the ultra-left in Lebanon, killed for the ultra-right Grey Wolves in Turkey, escaped from prison, and fled to West Germany. The odd thing about him was that he had expressed a personal obsession to kill the Pope. Should they throw Mehmet Ali Agca back into the ocean, or give him funds and false papers along with a gun and let him run? In normal circumstances, the KGB response would have been the cautious one. Kill him. But the circumstances were not normal. Karol Wojtyła, the world's first Polish pope, was a major menace. Poland was in uproar. Communist rule there could be blown apart by the dissident solidarity movement. The dissident Wojtyła had already visited Poland once, with disastrous results from the Soviet point of view. He had to be stopped or discredited. The KGB replied to the Bulgars, "Go ahead, but we don't want to know." In May 1981, with money, false papers, and a gun, Agca was escorted to Rome, pointed in the right direction, and allowed his head. As a result, a lot of people had lost theirs.
"With respect, I do not believe the two can be compared," said Dr. Rogoff, who had principally devised Plan Aurora, and was prepared to defend it. "The Wojtyła affair was a disaster for three reasons. The target did not die. The assassin was caught alive. Worst of all, there was no highly developed, in-place disinformation conspiracy to blame, for example, the Italian or American extreme right. There should have been a tidal wave of believable evidence available for release, proving to the world it was the right who put Agca up to it." The General Secretary nodded like an old lizard. "Here," proceeded Rogoff, "the situation is different. There are fallbacks and cutouts at every stage. The executant would be a top professional who would end his own life before capture. The physical artifacts are mostly harmless to look at, and none can be traced back to the USSR. The executant officer cannot survive the execution of the plan, and there are subsequent sub-plans to place the blame firmly and convincingly on the Americans." The General Secretary turned to General Marchenko. "Would it work?" he asked. The three committee members were uncomfortable. It would have been easier to grasp the General Secretary's reaction than agree with it, but he had given nothing away. Marchenko took breath and nodded.
"It is feasible," he agreed. "I believe it would take from 10 to 16 months to put into operation."
"Comrade Colonel?" asked the General Secretary of Philby. Philby's stutter increased as he spoke. It always did when he was under stress.
"As to the risks, I am not best able to judge them, nor the question of technical feasibility. As to effect, it would, beyond any doubt, swing over 10% of the British floating vote into a hasty decision to vote Labour."
"Comrade Professor Krylov?"
"I have to oppose it, Comrade General Secretary. I regard it as extremely hazardous in execution and its possible consequences. It is completely contrary to the terms of the Fourth Protocol. If that is ever breached, we may all suffer."
The General Secretary seemed lost in meditation, which no one was about to disturb. The hooded eyes brooded behind the glinting glasses for 5 minutes. At length he raised his head. "There are no notes, no tape recordings, no shreds of this plan outside this room."
"None," agreed the four committee men.
"Gather up the files and folders and pass them to me," said the General Secretary. When this was done, he went on, using his habitual monotone. "It is reckless, crazy, adventurous,
"'and dangerous beyond belief,' he intoned. "'The committee is disbanded. "'You are to return to your professions "'and never mention either the Albion Committee "'or Plan Aurora again.' "'He was still sitting there, staring at the table, "'when the four subdued and humbled men trooped out. "'They put on their coats and hats in silence, "'hardly meeting each other's eyes, "'and were led to their cars downstairs.' In the hollow courtyard, they each climbed into their own car. In his personal Volga, Philby waited for driver Grigoriev to start the engine. But the man just sat there. The other three limousines swept out of the square, under the arch, and into the boulevard. There was a tap on Philby's window. He wound it down to see the face of Major Pavlov. "Will you come with me, please, Comrade Colonel?" Philby's heart sank. He understood now that he knew too much. He was the one foreigner in the group. The General Secretary had a reputation for tying up loose ends rather permanently. He followed Major Pavlov back into the building. 2 minutes later, he was shown back into the General Secretary's sitting room. The old man was still in his wheelchair at the low coffee table. He gestured Philby to a seat. In trepidation, the British traitor took it. "What did you really think of it?" asked the General Secretary softly. Philby swallowed hard. "Ingenious, audacious, hazardous, but if it worked, effective," he said. "It's brilliant," murmured the General Secretary, "and it is going ahead, but under my personal auspices. This is to be no one else's operation, just mine, and you will be closely involved in it." "May I ask one thing?" Philby ventured. "Why me? I'm a foreigner. Even if I have served the Soviet Union all my life and lived here for a third of it, I am still a foreigner." "Precisely," replied the General Secretary. "And you have no patronage except mine. You could not begin to conspire against me. You will take leave of your wife and family and dismiss your driver. You will take up residence in the guest suites at my dacha at Usovo. There you will put together the team that will undertake Plan Aurora. You will have any authority you need. It will come from my office at the Central Committee. You, personally, will not show yourself." He pressed a buzzer under the table. "You will work at all times under the eye of this man. I believe you already know him." The door had opened. In it stood the impassive, cold visage of Major Pavlov. "He is highly intelligent and extremely suspicious," said the General Secretary with approval. "He is also totally loyal. He happens to be my nephew." As Philby rose to accompany the Major, the General Secretary held out a slip of paper to him. It was a flimsy from the First Chief Directorate, marked for the personal attention of the General Secretary of the CPSU. Philby looked in disbelief. "Yes," said the General Secretary. "It reached me yesterday. You will not have General Marchenko's 10 to 16 months. It appears Mrs. Thatcher is going to make her move in June. We must make ours 1 week before that." Philby let out his breath slowly. In 1916 it had taken 10 days to complete the Russian Revolution. Britain's greatest turncoat of them all was being given just 90 days to guarantee the British one.
Part 2, Chapter 9. When John Preston landed at Jan Smuts Airport on the morning of the 13th, the local head of station, a tall, thin, blond man called Dennis Gray, was there to meet him. From the observation terrace, two South African NIS men watched his arrival, but made no move to come closer. Customs and immigration were a formality, and within 30 minutes of touchdown, the two Englishmen were speeding north to Pretoria. Preston looked at the landscape of the High Veld with curiosity. It did not look much like his impression of Africa, just a modern six-lane blacktop highway running across a bare plain and flanked by modern European-style farms and factories. "I've booked you into the Burgers Park," said Gray, "in central Pretoria. I was told you wanted to stay in a hotel rather than at the residency." "Yes," said Preston. "Thank you. We'll go and check in first. We have an appointment to meet the Beast at 11. The not-too-affectionate title had originally been bestowed upon General Van den Berg,
a police general and head of the former Bureau of State Security, the boss. After the so-called Muldergate scandal of 1979, the unhappy marriage of the South African state's intelligence arm and its security police had been dissolved, to the great relief of the professional intelligence officers and the Foreign Service, some of whom had been consistently embarrassed by the boss's brass-knuckled tactics. The intelligence arm had been reconstituted under the title National Intelligence Service, and General Henri Pinard had moved across from his post as head of military intelligence. He was not a police general, but a military one, and while not a lifelong intelligence officer, I.O., like Sir Nigel Irvine, his years garnering military intelligence had taught him there were more ways to kill a cat than thumping it with blunt objects. General Fontenberg had passed into retirement, still prepared to tell anyone who had listened to him that the hand of God was upon him. Unkindly, the British had passed his nickname onto the shoulders of General Pinard. Preston registered into the hotel on Van der Vaart Street, dumped his bags, had a quick wash and shave, and joined Gray in the lobby at 10:30. From there they drove to Union Building. The seat of most of the South African government is a huge, long, ochre-brown sandstone block, 3 stories high, its 400-yard frontage studded by 4 colonnaded projections. It stands in central Pretoria, on a hill gazing south across a valley, along whose bed runs Kerkstraat, and the esplanade at the front of the block commands a panoramic view across the valley to the brown hills of the Highveld to the south, topped by the squat, square mass of the Voortrekker Monument. Dennis Gray presented his identity at the reception desk and mentioned his appointment. In minutes, a young official had appeared to lead them to the office of General Pinard. The headquarters of the NIS chief is on the top floor at the western end of the building. Gray and Preston were led down interminable corridors decorated in what appeared to be a standard South African civil service brown and cream motif with a heavy accent on dark wood panelling. The general's office is at the end of the last corridor on the 3rd floor, flanked by an office on the right containing 2 secretaries and another on the left containing 2 staff officers. The official knocked on the last door, waited for the gruff command to enter, and showed the British visitors in. It was a fairly sombre, formal office containing a large and obviously cleared desk facing the door, with a set of 4 leather club chairs grouped round a low table near the windows, which looked down towards Kerkstraat and across the valley to the hills. There were a number of what were apparently operational maps, coyly covered in green curtains round the walls. General Pinard was a big, heavy man, who rose as they entered and walked forward to shake hands. Gray made the introductions, and the general gestured them to the club chairs. Coffee was served, but the conversation remained at the level of small talk. Gray took the hint, made his farewells, and left. General Pinard stared at Preston for some time. "So, Mr. Preston," he said in almost unaccented English, "the subject of our diplomat, Jan Marais. I have already told Sir Nigel, and now I tell you, he does not work for me or my government, at least not as a controller of agents in Britain. You are here to try and find out who he does work for." "That's my job, General, if I can." General Pinard nodded several times. "I have given Sir Nigel my word that you will have our complete cooperation here, and I will abide by my word." "Thank you, General. I am going to attach you to one of my 2 personal staff officers. He will help you in anything you need, obtain files that you may wish to examine, interpret if necessary. You speak any Afrikaans?" "No, General, not a word." "Then there will be some translating to be done, perhaps some interpreting." He pressed a buzzer on the table, and in seconds the door opened to admit a man of the same physical size as the General, but much younger. Preston put him in his early 30s. He had ginger hair and sandy eyebrows. "Let me introduce Captain Andres Fulhum. Andy, this is Mr. John Preston from London, the one you will be working with." Preston rose to shake hands. He sensed a thinly veiled hostility in the young Afrikaner, perhaps a mirror of his superior's better masked feelings. "I have put a room at your disposal down the corridor," said General Pinard. "Well, let's waste no more time, gentlemen. Please get on with it." When they were alone in the office set aside for them, Fulhum asked, "What would you like to start with, Mr. Preston?" Preston sighed inwardly. The casual first name informality back at Charles and Gordon was a lot easier to get on with. "The personal file on Jan Marais, if you please, Captain Fulhum." The captain's triumph was evident as he produced it from a desk drawer.
"We have, of course, been going through it already," he said. "I took it out of Foreign Ministry personnel registry myself some days ago." He placed it in front of Preston, a big fat file in a buff cover. "Let me synthesize what we've been able to glean from it, if this will help you. Marais entered the South African Foreign Service in Cape Town in the spring of 1946. He has been in the service for 40 years, a bit more, and is due to retire in December. He comes from a perfect Afrikaner background and has never come under the slightest suspicion. That is why his behavior in London appears such a mystery." Preston nodded. He did not need it spelt out any more clearly. The view here was that London had made a mistake. He opened the file. Among the top documents was a sheaf handwritten in English. "That," said Fulyun, "is his handwritten autobiography, a requirement of candidates for the Foreign Service. In those days, when the United Party under Jan Smuts was in power, there was a much greater use of English than today. Today, such a document would be written in Afrikaans. Of course, candidates must be fluent in both languages." "Then I suppose we'd better start with it," said Preston. "While I read it, could you please make a synopsis of his career while in the service? Especially foreign postings. Where, when, and for how long?" "All right," nodded Fulyun. "If he did go rotten, if he was turned, it probably happened somewhere abroad." Fulyun's stress on the word "if" was just enough to imply his doubt, and the corrosive effect of foreigners upon good Afrikaners came out in the word "abroad." Preston began to read. "I was born in August 1925 in the small farming town of Duivelskloof in the northern Transvaal, the only son of a farmer in the Mutseki Valley just outside the town. My father, Lawrence Marais, was a pure Afrikaner, but my mother Mary was an Anglo. It was an unusual marriage in those days, but because of it, I was brought up fluent in both English and Afrikaans. My father was considerably older than my mother, who was of frail disposition and died when I was 10 in one of the typhoid epidemics that in those days swept that region from time to time. My father was 46 when I was born, and my mother only 25. He farmed potatoes and tobacco mainly, and also some chickens, geese, turkeys, cattle, sheep, and wheat. All his life he was a strong supporter of the United Party, and I was named after Marshal Jan Smuts." Preston broke off. "I suppose all this would not have done his candidature any harm," he suggested. "No harm at all," said Fulyun, looking over the passages. "The United Party was still in power then. The National Party only won the country in 1948. Preston read on. "When I was 7, I went to the local farm school in Duivelskloof, and at the age of 12 went on to the Marensky High, which had been founded 5 years earlier. After the outbreak of war in 1939, my father, who was a keen admirer of Britain and the Empire, followed every item of news about the war in Europe on his wireless set, sitting on the stoop in the evenings after work. After my mother died, we had become even closer, and I too soon began to yearn to take part in the war. 2 days after my 18th birthday, in August 1943, I said goodbye to my father and took the train to Petersburg, and then changed for the line south to Pretoria. My father came as far as Petersburg, and my last sight of him was standing on the platform there, waving me off to the war. The next day I walked into defense headquarters in Pretoria, formally attested, signed on, and was sent to Roberts Heights camp for basic training, kitting out, square bashing, and small arms instruction. There I also volunteered to be red-tabbed." "What does red-tabbed mean?" asked Preston. Fulyun looked up from his writing. "In those days, only volunteers could be sent to fight outside the borders of South Africa," he said. "They could not be compelled. Those volunteering for combat overseas were given a red tab to wear. From Roberts Heights, I was posted to the Witwatersrand Rifles, De La Rey Regiment, which had been amalgamated after the losses at Tobruk to form the Wets De La Rey. We were sent by train to a transit camp at Hay Paddock near Pietermaritzburg, and attached to reinforcements for the SA 6th Division, awaiting a transport to Italy. Finally, at Durban, we were all shipped out on the Duchess of Richmond, up through the Suez Canal, and disembarked in late January at Taranto. Most of that Italian spring we were moving up towards Rome, and it was with the 6th Division, then composed of the 12th SA Motorized Brigade and the 11th SA Armored Brigade, that we in the Wits de la Rey went through Rome and began the move on Florence.
On the 13th of July, I was forward of Monte Benici in the Chianti Mountains with a scouting patrol from C Company. In thickly wooded country, I became separated from the rest of the patrol after dark, and minutes later found myself surrounded by German troops of the Hermann Göring Division. I was, as they say, put in the bag. I was lucky to stay alive, but they put me in a truck with some other Allied prisoners and took us to a cage, or temporary camp, at a place called La Tarina, north of Florence. The senior South African NCO, I recall, was Warrant Officer Snyman. It was not to be for long. As the Allies advanced through Florence, we were suddenly subjected to a brutal night evacuation. It was chaos. Some prisoners tried to escape and were shot down. They were left lying in the road as the trucks rolled over them. From the trucks we were put into rail cars built for cattle, and went north for days, through the Alps, and finally to a POW camp at Moosberg, 25 miles north of Munich. Even this was not for long. After only 14 days, half of us were marched out of Moosberg and back to the railhead, where we were entrained in cattle trucks again. With hardly any food or drink, we rolled across Germany for 6 days and nights. And in late August 1944, we were finally disembarked again and marched to another and much bigger camp. It was, we discovered, called Stalag 344, and was at Lambsdorff, near Breslau, in what was then German Silesia. I think Stalag 344 must have been the worst Stalag of them all. There were 11,000 Allied POWs there, on virtual starvation rations kept alive mainly by Red Cross parcels. As I was then a corporal, I was required to join working parties, and was sent every day with many others by truck to work at a synthetic petrol factory 12 miles away. That winter in the Silesian plain was bitter. One day, just before Christmas, a truck broke down. Two POWs tried to mend it while the German guards kept them covered. Some of us were allowed to jump down near the tailboard. A young South African soldier near me stared at the pine forest only 30 yards away, looked at me, and raised an eyebrow. I never know why I did it, but the next moment we were both running through the thigh-deep snow while our comrades jostled the German guards to upset their aim. We made the forest line alive, and ran on into the heart of the woods.
"Do you want to go out for lunch?" asked Verlun. "We have a canteen here."
"Could we have sandwiches and coffee here, do you think?" asked Preston.
"Sure. I'll ring for them."
Preston resumed the tale of Jan Marais. "We soon discovered that we had an effect that jumped from the frying pan into the fire, except that it was not a fire but a freezing hell, where the night temperatures sank to 30 degrees below zero. We had our feet wrapped in paper inside our boots, but neither this nor our greatcoats could keep out the cold. After 2 days, we were weak and at the point of giving ourselves up. On the second night, we were trying to sleep in a tumbled barn, when we were roughly jerked awake. We thought it must be the Germans, but with Afrikaans I could understand some German words, and these voices were not German. They were Polish. We had been discovered by a band of Polish partisans. They came within an inch of shooting us as German deserters, but I screamed that we were English, and one of them seemed to understand. It seemed that while most of the urban dwellers of Breslau and Lambsdorff were ethnic Germans, the peasants were of Polish stock, and as the Russian army advanced, numbers of them had taken to the woods to harass the retreating Germans. There were two kinds of partisans, the communist and the Catholic. We were lucky. It was a group of Catholic resistance fighters who had taken us in. They kept us through that bitter winter as the Russian guns rumbled in the east and the advance came closer. Then, in January, my comrade caught pneumonia. I tried to nurse him through it, but without antibiotics he died, and we buried him in the forests." Preston munched his sandwiches moodily and sipped his coffee. There were only a few pages left, he noted. "In March 1945, the Russian army was suddenly upon us. In the woods we could hear their armor rumbling westwards down the roads. The Poles elected to stay in the forests, but I could take no more of it. They showed me the way to go, and one morning, with my hands above my head, I stumbled out of the forest and gave myself up to a group of Russian soldiers. At first they thought I was a German, and nearly shot me, but the Poles had told me to shout 'Angliski,' which I did repeatedly.
They put up their rifles and called an officer. He spoke no English, but after examining my dog tag, said something to his soldiers, and they were all smiles. But if I hoped for an early repatriation, I was wrong again. They handed me over to the NKVD. For 5 months, in a series of damp and icy cells, I was accorded brutal treatment, all of it in solitary confinement. I was interrogated repeatedly with third degree in an attempt to make me confess I was a spy. I refused and was sent naked back to my cell. By the late spring, the war was ending in Europe, but I did not know this, my health broke completely and I was given a pallet bed to sleep on and better food, though still uneatable by our South African standards. Then some word must have come from the top. In August 1945, more dead than alive, I was taken many miles in a truck and finally, at Potsdam in Germany, handed over to the British Army. They were more kind than I can say, and after a period in a military hospital outside Bielefeld, I was sent back to England. I spent a further 3 months at Killearn EMS Hospital, north of Glasgow, and finally, in December 1945, I sailed on the Île-de-France from Southampton to Cape Town, arriving in late January this year. It was in Cape Town that I heard of the death of my dear father, my only relative left in the world. It caused me such distress that my health suffered a relapse, and I entered the Weinberg Military Hospital here at Cape Town, where I stayed for a further 2 months. I am now discharged, given a clean bill of health, and hereby apply to join the South African Foreign Service. Preston closed the file, and Viljoen looked up. Well, said the South African, he has had the steady and blameless, if unspectacular, career since then, rising to the rank of First Secretary. He has had 8 foreign postings, all the countries firmly pro-Western. That's quite a lot, but then he's a bachelor, and that can make life easier in the service, except at the level of ambassador or minister, where a wife is more or less expected. You still think he went rotten somewhere along the line? Preston shrugged. Viljoen leaned over and tapped the folder. You see what those Russian bastards did to him. That's why I think you're wrong, Mr. Preston. So, he likes ice cream, and he made a wrong number phone call. A coincidence. Maybe, said Preston. This life story, there's something odd about it. Captain Viljoen shook his head. We've had this file in our hands ever since your Sir Nigel Irvine contacted the General. We have been over and over it. It's absolutely accurate. Every name, date, place, army camp, military unit, campaign, and tiny detail. Even to the crops they used to grow before the war in the Mutseki Valley. The agriculture people confirmed that. Now they grow tomatoes and avocados up there, but in those days, potatoes and tobacco. Nobody could have invented that story. No, if he went wrong at all, which I doubt, it was somewhere abroad. Preston looked glum. Outside the windows, dusk was falling. All right, said Viljoen. I'm here to help you. Where do you want to start next? I'd like to start at the beginning, said Preston. This place, Duivelskloof, is it far? About a 4-hour drive. You want to go there? Yes, please. Could we start early? Say at 6 tomorrow morning. I'll get a car from the pool and be at your hotel at 6, said Viljoen. It's a long haul on the road north to Zimbabwe, but the motorway is modern, and Viljoen had drawn a Chevere without insignia, the car usually driven by the NIS. It ate up the miles through Nylstrom and Potgietersrust to Pietersburg, which they reached in 3 hours. The drive gave Preston a chance to see the great limitless horizons of Africa that impress the European visitor accustomed to smaller dimensions. At Pietersburg, they turned east and ran for 50 kilometres over flat, middle veld, more endless horizons under a robin's egg blue vault of sky, until they reached the bluff called Buffalo Hill, where the middle veld drops to the Mutseki Valley. As they started down the twisting gradient, Preston drew in his breath in amazement. Far below lay the valley, rich and lush, its open floor strewn with 1,000 beehive-shaped African huts, the rondavels, surrounded by kraals, cattle pens, and mealie gardens. Some of the rondavels were perched on the side of the Buffelberg, but most were scattered across the floor of the Mutseki.